KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What the United States is setting itself up for is not just short-term pain, but long-term pain as well.
With the stock market diving in response to an onslaught of tariffs, is this short-term pain in exchange for long-term gain?
It's Friday, March 14th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. With measles outbreaks in Texas and New Mexico, doctors say this is a good time to remember just how dangerous measles can be.
He started getting lost between classes. Lost, like he couldn't find what class to go to next.
Also, our series about controversial broadcasters takes on Dorothy Thompson, a famous foreign correspondent in the 1930s and 40s.
She became identified as the sort of immediate opponent of Hitler. Dorothy versus Hitler. Hitler versus Dorothy Thompson.
Plus, Grandpas United, the group recruits older men to visit schools and serve as mentors.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Republican-led Senate, with help from 10 Democrats, passed a stopgap bill to avert a government shutdown with hours to spare. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is facing backlash from Democrats for his role in the vote.
House Democrats, who largely voted against the partisan bill because of federal program cuts, rebuked Leader Schumer for reversing course on plans to oppose Republicans. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, asked by reporters if it's time for new Senate leadership, responded by saying, next question.
We are not afraid of a government funding showdown, and we will win that showdown because we stand on the side of the American people.
Schumer argued that a shutdown would be devastating and could lead to more dismantling of the federal government. But other Democrats said it was a lost moment of party leverage. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
Hamas says it is willing to release the one remaining living Israeli-American hostage, along with the bodies of four others. They've been held in Gaza since the October 2023 attack on Israel. Militant group made the announcement online on its Telegram channel. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
In that Telegram statement, Hamas said it will release 21-year-old Edam Alexander, an Israeli soldier and American dual citizen who was serving at the time of his capture. It also agreed to release the bodies of, quote, four other dual nationals. It's unclear what the terms of their release would be or whether a formal proposal has been put forward to either side by the mediators. The statement comes after the U.S. has, in recent weeks, held direct talks with Hamas, a major shift in U.S. policy. Both U.S. officials and Hamas confirmed they discussed the release of American hostages. In response to the announcement, Israel called Hamas's willingness to release the Americans, quote, alleged, and said it was intended to sabotage negotiations. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
A SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket lifting off the pad at Kennedy Space Center in Florida today. Commander Anne McClain, one of four astronauts on board headed to the International Space Station, thanked everyone involved in the mission after successfully reaching orbit.
Thank you to all of the teams from across the world who contributed to the launch today. Spaceflight is tough, but humans are tougher. Days like today are made possible only when people choose to do the harder right over the easier wrong. Build relationships, choose cooperation, and believe in the inherent goodness of all people across the world.
The joint mission between NASA and SpaceX means that astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, whose planned 8-day stay at the ISS turned into 9 months because of problems with Boeing's Starliner spacecraft, will soon be coming home. Stocks rallied on Wall Street today, but were still down overall for the week. The Dow gained 674 points. The Nasdaq was up 451 points. This is NPR. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy says he's prepared to work with the Trump administration and Elon Musk's Doge agency to downsize the post office. DeJoy agreeing to cut 10,000 workers and billions of dollars from the budget. In a letter sent to members of Congress, it says Doge will assist the Postal Service address the big problems in the agency faces. USPS employs about 640,000 people. The U.S. has reached out to Denmark and other European countries asking for help supplying eggs amid a severe shortage brought in on part by outbreak of a bird flu. Adrian Murray has more from Copenhagen.
Letters were sent to egg-producing nations by the U.S. Department of Agriculture last month, Reuters reports, even as Trump threatened Denmark and the European Union with tariffs. Jørn Nyberg Larsen, head of the Danish Egg Association, said Europe doesn't have a big surplus of eggs, but that they want to help their American friends. More than 20 million egg-laying chickens have died or were culled in the last quarter in the US, according to data from the USDA, while prices have spiraled to record highs last month. For NPR News, I'm Adrienne Murray in Copenhagen.
Gold is often viewed as a hedge against global turbulence, and that appears to be the case at the moment, with prices for the precious metals soaring. Gold futures rose above $3,000 a troy ounce for the first time ever this week, and spot gold closed only slightly below that. The Trump administration's on-again, off-again tariffs have caused extensive jitters on world markets, helping push gold prices higher. Crude oil futures prices rebounded today, oil up 63 cents a barrel to $67.18 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
I'm Ari Shapiro, also in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A little disturbance. A period of transition. A detox period. These are all phrases that President Trump and his administration have used to describe the economy as the stock market has plunged in response to an onslaught of tariffs. But President Trump is adamant that his tariffs will ultimately bring revenue, jobs, and factories to the U.S. So the question is this short-term pain in exchange for long-term gain? Or are these just the early signs of a recession? To help us answer that question, we're joined now by economist Matt Slaughter. He's the dean at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. So can you just first try to spell out, what is President Trump's explanation, as you understand it, for what is happening in the economy right now? And where does he say the economy is headed?
Sure. I think the metaphor of short-term pain is the president articulating that his attempt to try to restructure the American economy will generate costs and disruptions in the short term. I think what's being missed, however, is that the more accurate forecast is that what the United States is setting itself up for is not just short-term pain, but long-term pain as well.
Well, I was just going to ask you, because President Trump is trying to assure people that any disturbance that's felt right now is only temporary. Is it only temporary? It sounds like you don't think it is temporary.
It is unlikely to be temporary. The breadth and depth of the tariffs that are being posed and the possible additional policies that might restrict international investment and immigration, those are going to damage the United States, not just in the short term, but in the long term as well. I think a fundamental reason that President Trump was elected and then reelected was his astute understanding that globalization has not benefited every single worker and company and community. Mm-hmm. But what is being missed is that for decades, all those connections to the global economy through trade and investment and immigration have really spurred gains for scores of millions of Americans.
Well, one specific goal that Trump has mentioned is that he wants to rebuild U.S. manufacturing. Do you think his tariff plan can ultimately truly accomplish that?
I worry that it won't. If you look at the data, the strongest companies in the United States in manufacturing and in services as well, mm-hmm. they tend to be the globally connected companies, the ones that through importing intermediate inputs and exporting their products to the rest of the world. And those tend to be the more productive, the more innovative companies, and the ones that ultimately end up paying higher wages and generating better jobs, which is rightly what the president is focusing on.
But is there an argument to be made that these tariffs can still help a little bit? Like the head of the United Auto Workers, Sean Fain, who's been a big critic of Donald Trump, he's actually come out in favor of these tariffs. Like here he is on ABC's This Week.
Tariffs are an attempt to stop the bleeding from the hemorrhaging of jobs in America for the last 33 years.
Is Fain wrong to think that these higher tariffs will help the U.S. auto workers whom he represents?
No, he's not necessarily wrong that auto workers in particular parts of the auto industry may benefit from higher tariffs that limit the competition that certain companies face from imports coming in from the rest of the world. But what's essential in understanding the overall U.S. economy is the kinds of tariffs that are being imposed almost always generate greater harm in other companies. So, for example, in recent days, the United States has dramatically escalated our tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum. Mm-hmm. Well, the data show very clearly there's somewhere between 30 to 50 jobs in steel-using industries in America for every job there is in a steel-producing. And so the aggregate impact on U.S. manufacturing tends to be quite harmful.
And we should note, like, the president did not rule out a possible recession. Do you think a recession is likely?
It's getting more likely by the day. The wider and broader and higher these tariff barriers go up, the more likely it is that businesses in America are going to suffer losses in profits. They're going to be less productive. There's going to be jobs lost. And it's very clear that American consumers, smartly and rightly, are recognizing the likelihood that the prices that they pay for goods and services are going to go up.
Matthew Slaughter is an economist and the dean at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Wildfires have ignited across the country this year, from Southern California to New York. And above-normal fire activity is anticipated for large parts of the country this month, including in much of Texas. This fire risk comes as residents of the Panhandle are marking 1 year since the largest wildfire in Texas history. It consumed over 1 million acres. And as the Texas Newsroom's Rachel Osier Lindley reports, residents say recovery will take years.
Canadian is one of dozens of idyllic-looking small towns dotting the Panhandle Plains. Like everyone in this community of 2,200, Loria Zell Brown has seen wildfires before, but nothing like the Smokehouse Creek fire.
Everybody I know, you know, lost something.
Zell Brown is the editor and publisher of the Canadian Record newspaper. She's lived here most of her life.
It had moved so quickly and done so much damage in so little time. It was shocking to see.
Two people were killed. Businesses and homes were destroyed, including 53 houses in Canadian and more on the ranches surrounding the town. Over 15,000 head of cattle died in the fire.
Our economy is largely based on ranching, on cattle, so it's a way of life.
Around 85% of Texas's beef cattle come from the region, which has experienced drought for years.
Seatbelt.
Outside of town, Shane Pennington and his wife Tatum climb into their white pickup truck to survey the Fields Ranch.
It's a small place compared to a lot of them in this part of the world. It's about 8,000 acres.
The Penningtons manage the ranch, where their families lived for more than 20 years.
And this little pasture we just pulled into, it's right next to the Canadian River. This was actually, this little area here was where most of the dead cattle were that we found.
Like, when we drove down here, we had no idea what we were fixing to see. And, like, it's hard to enter down here because it was so graphic and terrible. I mean,
Someone was still alive.
Yeah.
Couldn't get up. And,
yeah.
You know, just
fallen. And everywhere you look, there's just dead, burned cattle and calves.
They say the herd's small right now, just over 100, when it's usually three times the size. Since the fire, the Penningtons have been in recovery mode, including replacing 18 miles of fences.
It can cost anywhere from, $15,000 to $20,000 a mile. We're thinking maybe we've got another probably 7 or 8 miles.
The fire was still burning last year when Xcel Energy acknowledged one of their power lines started the fire. 1 year later, Xcel's facing several lawsuits. A company representative told me it's already resolved more than half of the claims it's received from landowners and said Xcel's making infrastructure improvements. A report from the Texas legislature estimated the fire's impact could ultimately exceed $1 billion. Now, the state legislature is considering increasing funding for fighting wildfires. In some rural areas like this, the fire departments are run by volunteers. After the initial shock over the damage caused by the fire, Canadian transitioned into a massive relief effort.
And that went on for months.
Loria Zell Brown says despite the devastation around Canadian, everyone's pitched in to help, donating their time and supplies.
They filled up the county exhibition center, and they could have filled it up 100 more times.
Mallory Wilhelm's a mother of five and the wife of a rancher. The family's rebuilding their lives in a new home after losing theirs in the fire.
When you go through something like that, that's when you see, wow, people are awesome, and good has come from it. Beauty from ashes, I mean, truly.
While some residents have moved away, most have stayed in Canadian. People say it'll take 3, 5, even 10 years for the region and ranching industry to recover. On the Fields Ranch, Shane Pennington says, while there may not be enough grass for his cattle right now, there is enough for another fire.
We're awful dry right now. You know, if something kicked off, sparked off, we would burn again.
After all, as Tatum Pennington says, this is the windy season.
March always has those 60-mile-per-hour, 70-mile-per-hour sustained wind days for some reason.
Something she says puts everyone on edge after what they've been through. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Osier-Lindley in Canadian, Texas.
This week, we're thinking about 5 years ago when the pandemic hit and changed the world. John Daly from Colorado Public Radio brings us this reflection from one frontline health provider who shared his experience from back then.
Kurt Poppenfuss is a loquacious 67-year-old doctor. He practices on the rural eastern plains of Colorado. 5 years ago, he was taking care of patients at the 10-bed Keefe Memorial Hospital in Cheyenne County. He's still chief of staff and medical director there. But before vaccines were available, he himself caught coronavirus, as he told NPR in the fall of 2020.
The Rona beast is a very nasty beast, and it is not fun. It has a very mean temper. It loves a fight, and it loves to keep coming after you.
When he got sick, he drove himself 3 hours to Denver, followed by county deputies, to make sure he made it to the hospital, where he was admitted with pneumonia. Today, he says, the pandemic taught him plenty, including the importance of both the people who work the land in rural Colorado and those who provide their health care.
It reinforced pretty much taking care of the rural folks, because with all the supply chains and stuff I was watching, those are the guys that really grow the food that the cities eat.
He says the pandemic was rough, challenging, and tragic, but also an opportunity to learn new things.
What do they call them, pivot points? It was a pivot point in history.
It's easy to forget now how many open questions there were at the start of the pandemic, he says, with no vaccine available.
I'll tell you what, though, in those 5 years, it definitely advanced science by a couple decades. The federal spigot opened up to pour tons of money into research.
Poppenfuss eventually developed long COVID, what he calls COVID brain. The experience was a wake-up call, teaching him about self-care, something he never learned in his medical education.
We were kind of trained to sacrifice yourself on the altar of medicine, taking care of other people because that's the noble cause.
He did return to work.
COVID was a harsh reminder that, yeah, you better take care of yourself, because if you can't take care of yourself, how are you going to take care of other people?
Dr. Kurt Poppenfuss says he has bounced back, but he's also cut back his long hours at the hospital. For NPR News, I'm John Daly in Denver.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We're bringing you another installment of Radio Diaries series Making Waves about influential and controversial American broadcasters. Back in the 1940s, Dorothy Thompson was known as the First Lady of American Journalism. A foreign correspondent at the outbreak of World War II, she wrote for newspapers and broadcast to millions of radio listeners. She became known for her brazen but educated attacks on Hitler's fascist policies. But by the end of the decade, she would find her reputation stained. Radio Diaries brings us this story.
The National Broadcasting Company brings you at this time a talk by the noted woman commentator, Dorothy Thompson. Miss Thompson.
I don't know how you feel, but I feel as though I'd like to take a little time off to think over and digest what's happened in these last days.
My name is Leslie Dorothy Lewis. I'm 63 and I'm hearing my grandmother's voice for the first time. It almost makes me cry.
The reports from Poland today are that the Germans are attacking fiercely on all fronts, the victims of which are wholly civilian.
She was saying some very dark things because it was a very dark subject she was addressing, but it was done in a feminine style. No one had ever heard it done like that before at that time. You had to always hear about a man like Edward R. Murrow or somebody like that.
And I have an idea this war is going to go on being surprising. Let us wait with calmness and see. Good night.
I'm Peter Kurth, and I am the author of American Cassandra, The Life of Dorothy Thompson. Dorothy Thompson lived in Berlin, and she first encountered the Nazi movement in the early 20s.
Und in diesen 13 Jahren haben sie auf allen Gebieten jammervoll versagt.
No one was taking them all that seriously in terms of their taking power, but she kept her eye on them.
My name is Corinne Walther. I am a professor of history at Georgetown University in Qatar. She comes to interview Hitler in 1931. She writes, he is formless, almost faceless. He is ill-poised, insecure. He is the very prototype of the little man. You know, there's that expression, men's greatest fear is to be laughed at by a woman.
Adolf Hitler, the indomitable Nazi leader, is now Chancellor of Germany.
Hitler's first task as Chancellor was to get rid of his rivals. Dorothy was at her hotel in Berlin, and the Gestapo knocked on the hotel door room and handed her papers saying she had 24 hours to leave the country.
My expulsion from Germany is only interesting insofar as it throws some light upon the position of the foreign correspondent in Germany. It's the business of journalism to report everything that happens.
After Dorothy came back to the United States, she was on the airwaves night and day, practically. She became identified as the sort of immediate opponent of Hitler. Dorothy versus Hitler. Hitler versus Dorothy Thompson.
I am an American woman and mother, and I speak for the women of my country, to Adolf Hitler. Shall we congratulate you, Adolf Hitler, that Europe is a shambles?
Her broadcast ended up being often appeals to rally and to strengthen in opposition to fascism internationally.
There are 3.5 million Jews in Poland. They know that they won't even be citizens of the Third Reich, but will be treated as citizens of the second class.
She really understood what Hitler wanted to do. His attack against Jews as a race. And that's one of the things that makes her so wonderful at this time, because there were clearly so many Americans who were fine with it.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my very great privilege to welcome you to another mass demonstration by the German-American Bund.
In 1939, there was a huge rally of the German-American Bund, an organization of American Nazis, gathering at Madison Square Garden. And Dorothy came in and she sat in the front row of the press box, and while these speeches were being made, all she did was burst out laughing and crying things like nonsense and oh please. The police had to come in because the American brown shirts were about to rough her up.
She made the cover of Time magazine, and they said that she and Eleanor Roosevelt were the two most influential women in the United States.
War against Germany is won. President Truman announced the official surrender.
After the Second World War, there was a refugee crisis around the Jewish population of Europe.
These are the final blows of a long persecution which has been forcing Jews out of Germany by tens of thousands. 6,000 to America, 23,000 to Palestine.
Dorothy was an avid, convinced, devoted Zionist, but she hadn't been there.
So she goes to visit Palestine in the summer of 1945.
Dorothy went to Palestine and saw refugees of the Palestinian population being forced off their own land. She saw a people uprooted.
It reminded her of the kind of hatred and violence that she had seen in Germany. She comes back and she says this: the Zionist project is not what I was led to believe. It is not going to grant equal rights for Arabs.
She said establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine was a recipe for perpetual war.
I am Dorothy Thompson. I have recently returned from visiting the scenes of the picture you are about to see.
She participates in a documentary that is made to raise funds for Palestinian refugees called The Sands of Sorrow.
Today in the Near East, a suffering people, the Palestine Arab refugees, are struggling for survival.
Financial assistance is urgently needed. I greatly hope you will want to give what you can.
This made her terribly unpopular.
She faces really immediate pushback from American Zionist organizations, as well as newspaper editors who had been publishing her columns, and they accuse her of anti-Semitism.
That got her dropped from the New York Post, and she did, in fact, struggle to find her place after that.
There's a great quote which she makes at the end of her life. I had to speak out about this, meaning attacks on Palestinian civilians, for the same reason I had to speak out about Hitler. But my Zionist friends do not seem to understand the universality of simple moral principles.
All of us must ask ourselves what it is that we live by. We must pledge renewed allegiance to a great liberal idea, the idea that men of many races and religions can live together in peace with each other.
Dorothy Thompson died in 1961. She was 67 years old. The story was produced by Micah Hazel and edited by Deborah George and the team at Radio Diaries. Tomorrow, on the series Making Waves, the black radio preacher who opposed Martin Luther King Jr. You can hear the rest of the Making Waves series on the Radio Diaries podcast.
This is NPR News.
Senator Chuck Schumer is worried about rising hatred on all sides.
It's almost a pincer. If you have it on the right and you have it on the left, the Jews feel alone and surrounded.
His book, Anti-Semitism in America, A Warning, and all the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
all Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump has pitched a ceasefire proposal to stop the fighting in Ukraine.
What he hasn't done is asked his Russian counterpart for many concessions.
It's actually a huge mistake to be nice to Putin. You should be able to be mean to everybody at the same time.
The new U.S.-Russia relationship after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says it will be a long journey, but he's optimistic about ongoing talks with Russia to end its three-year-old war and invasion of Ukraine. Rubio spoke to reporters following a series of meetings today with G7 ministers.
I think there is reason to be cautiously optimistic, but by the same token, we continue to recognize this is a difficult and complex situation. It will not be easy. It will not be simple. But we certainly feel like we're at least some steps closer to ending this war and bringing peace, but it's still a long journey.
The president of Ukraine has already agreed to a U.S. proposed 30-day ceasefire in the war, but Putin, who met yesterday with a White House special envoy, said he supports the effort but still has many reservations. In New York, outrage and fear are spreading at Columbia University after the Department of Homeland Security searched two campus residences. NPR's Adrian Florido says it comes less than a week after immigration agents arrested a prominent Palestinian student activist.
Columbia's interim president, Katrina Armstrong, emailed students and staff saying she was heartbroken to tell them that DHS agents had searched two campus apartments Thursday night. According to her note, no one was arrested or detained and no items were removed. She said the school had to allow the agents in because they had a signed judicial warrant. Students have been demanding the school do more to protect them as the Trump administration has targeted Columbia and promised to deport non-citizens who've participated in pro-Palestinian student activism. ICE agents arrested Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian student leader, last weekend as he was arriving at his campus apartment. Adrian Florido, NPR News, New York.
Stocks rallied one day after the S&P fell more than 10%. The Dow was up 1.5% today. This is NPR. The U.S. has put new visa restrictions on government officials in Thailand as part of a new State Department policy to sanction individuals who are complicit in forcibly returning vulnerable minorities back to China. NPR's Emily Fang explains.
The visa policy was announced shortly after Thailand revealed it had deported about 40 ethnic Uyghurs to China last month. The Uyghurs are a persecuted group in China, and hundreds of thousands of them have been detained in the last 7 years. The Uyghurs deported from Thailand to China had been offered asylum in the U.S., but a Thai official said they did not let the Uyghurs go because they feared retaliation from China. In 2015, Thailand deported more than 100 Uyghurs back to China despite backlash. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that the Thai officials involved in the most recent deportation order would have their access to the U.S. barred. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
A former reality TV star has won the longest ever Iditarod dog sled race in Alaska today, crediting the dogs. Jesse Holmes had previously finished in the top 10 five times. A lack of snow forced changes to the route, adding 129 miles to the normally 1,000-mile race across the Alaska wilderness. The grueling race took 10 days, 14 hours, and 55 minutes. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Measles keep spreading in West Texas. More than 250 people are reported to have contracted the disease, and the actual number is likely a lot higher. The virus has spread across the border into New Mexico. Now, this outbreak is happening in remote rural areas. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the nationwide risk remains low and that vaccination is the key to prevention. Doctors say it's a good time to remember how dangerous and long-lasting measles can be. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
Dr. Alex Vianovich has been a practicing pediatrician for more than 20 years. She says she's still haunted by the memory of a teenage boy she treated at the start of her career. The boy had contracted measles as a seven-month-old when he was too young to be vaccinated.
He got the virus from a child in his neighborhood who was unvaccinated.
It was a relatively mild case of measles, and the infant recovered. He grew up to be a healthy, bright kid.
He was an honor student and just a charming, delightful kid.
Then in middle school, he started to develop troubling symptoms.
He started getting lost between classes. Lost, like he couldn't find what class to go to next.
Worried, the teen's parents took him to a series of doctors to figure out what was wrong, until one finally suspected a condition called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, or SSPE. It's a degenerative neurological condition that typically develops 7 to 10 years after a measles infection. It's almost always fatal. Svianovich was part of the hospital team that confirmed the diagnosis.
The problem is that there is no treatment for it. And he basically became more and more incapacitated over time.
She says some 18 months later, the teenager died. SSPE was once considered quite rare. But Dr. Adam Ratner, a pediatric infectious disease specialist who wrote a history of measles, says data from outbreaks in the U.S. over the past several decades suggest that's not the case.
It turns out that in some age groups, especially in kids under about age 2, it's much more common than we thought.
Perhaps as common as 1 in 5,000 cases. Vaccination prevents not just SSPE, but also other serious complications that measles can cause, like pneumonia and severe brain swelling. It can even erase your immune memory. Stephen Ellidge is a researcher at Harvard who studies how the immune system responds to pathogens.
Not only does your brain have a memory, but your immune system has a memory of all the pathogens it's encountered in the past.
Your immune system holds on to those memories, so the next time it encounters a virus, it knows how to fight it. But measles can destroy the cells that retain those memories.
And when you lose that memory, then you're no longer immune to that particular pathogen. So the next time you get it, you've got to fight that battle all over again.
This effect is called immune amnesia. Ellidge says it happens to some extent with every measles infection, though its severity varies widely.
So whenever you get measles, you lose some of your immune memory. And the more severe your case of measles is, the longer it lasts, the more of your immune system is destroyed.
Some research suggests it can take 2 to 3 years for the immune system to recover. Adam Ratner says as vaccination rates fall, the U.S. is likely to see more and larger measles outbreaks.
There's no doubt that we will, in the future, see the long-term consequences of measles.
But he says we have a safe and powerful tool to prevent those consequences. Vaccines. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Before President Trump was in the White House, people competed to work for him on an NBC competition reality show called The Apprentice.
You're fired.
This week, Amazon added the first season of The Apprentice to Prime Video. More seasons are on the way, along with a Prime Video documentary and docuseries on First Lady Melania Trump. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to talk about Amazon's deals and how the broader TV landscape may be changing during Trump's second term. Hey there.
Hi.
So I need to mention before we get started, Amazon is among NPR's financial supporters. We do cover them like any other company. I will note Puck News is reporting Amazon is paying $40 million for these shows focused on Melania Trump, which prompts me to ask, is Amazon courting favor with the Trumps?
Well, certainly that's what some industry watchers, including me, are concerned about. I mean, especially given the way Amazon owner Jeff Bezos kept the Washington Post, which he also owns, from endorsing Trump's opponent Kamala Harris before the 2024 election. Now, Bezos has said he's optimistic about Trump's second term, and Amazon donated $1 million to the president's inaugural fund. We reached out to Amazon about the perception that these deals court favor from the president, but they wouldn't comment beyond what they've already said.
Well, and I'll jump in and note, I mean, it's possible, of course, that execs at Amazon just decided, look, the election proves there's a lot of interest in Donald and Melania Trump. Let's have some more TV projects about them.
Absolutely. But it's also quite a turnaround from 2015, when NBC severed ties with Trump following his derogatory comments about Mexican immigrants when he announced his first candidacy for president.
Okay, fair. So Amazon clearly sees a market out there for Melania Trump, for The Apprentice. Is this playing out, Eric, beyond Amazon? Talk to me about whether we're seeing a broader shift here.
I think there are more projects coming to television that target an audience that might be considered Trump-friendly. The Wall Street Journal's Joel Flint had a great story noting the success of Tim Allen's new ABC show, Shifting Gears, which features the comic as a gruff owner of a car restoration business. Now, Tim Allen is publicly conservative, and his character listens to Joe Rogan's podcast. And the A&E channel announced the return of Duck Dynasty, which is an unscripted show with stars who have appeared at Trump rallies. And Netflix also recently announced a deal with comic Tony Hinchcliffe, who called Puerto Rico, quote, a floating island of garbage during a rally for Trump in October.
Oh, yeah.
But some of these projects have been in the works for a while. I mean, ABC announced it was making a pilot for Allen's show about a year ago. So this could be a combination of TV programmers creating material for an audience they see expressing itself more prominently and a way of courting President Trump and the people who support him.
Are there other things going on, Eric, other trends that might also be informing these programming decisions?
For sure. I'm seeing more shows focused on Western culture, rural culture, country music, parts of pop culture championed by some conservatives. I think the success of the Western-themed TV drama Yellowstone inspired copycats, like a new drama coming on Netflix about Texas ranchers, Ransom Canyon. And Netflix also has been courting comics from the podcast Manosphere for a while, with recent specials from Andrew Schultz and Bert Kreischer.
It's interesting because it's such a contrast from these last few years when Hollywood was championing projects that captured diversity in America. Are those projects likely to be sidelined?
Well, certainly that's the fear. I mean, it takes a while to make some movies and TV shows, so we're still seeing new projects with strong racial diversity components, like a version of Snow White starring Rachel Ziegler, who is Latina. But we're also seeing lots of companies roll back their diversity and inclusion efforts following these anti-DEI executive orders from President Trump, including at PBS and Disney. Many Hollywood studios and TV networks created high-level diversity positions years ago because representation was so bad. With these rollbacks, there's serious concern we'll see the same old problems resurface that it took 20 years to overcome in the first place.
And NPR's TV critic, Eric Deggans, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Since taking office, President Trump has signed 89 executive orders. Our colleagues from The Indicator, Waylon Wong and Darian Woods, zoom in on one of these executive orders and what it could mean for the future independence of the Federal Reserve.
Trump signed an executive order in mid-February to make sure that agencies follow the president's priorities. It put tighter control on how these agencies spend and regulate. And it applied to agencies like the Security and Exchange Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Reserve.
The Federal Reserve has two main jobs. The first one is what we hear about most of the time, making sure there's not too much inflation or unemployment. That's what wonks call monetary policy.
The other main job is keeping banks running smoothly. And it does this by regulating and supervising the financial system. Both of these jobs are done at arm's length from Congress or the president. So when it came to these executive orders, there was one big asterisk for the Federal Reserve. It only applies to the Federal Reserve's role in safeguarding the financial system. It doesn't apply to the Fed's raising and lowering of interest rates to fight inflation and to protect jobs, you know, monetary policy. Catherine Judge is a law professor at Columbia University.
There is an effort to signal, look, we don't want to mess with monetary policy. So it seeks to provide a little bit of calm.
Catherine says it's widely accepted that less independent central banks end up with higher inflation.
Trump doesn't want to stoke fears that we're going to have persistent inflation by changing the leadership structure of the Fed or his control over the Fed in ways that would give him the ability to dictate interest rates.
The evidence is less clear about the effects of having the Fed's bank supervision and regulation role under the grip of politicians. But the big question is how this division would work in practice.
It also raises questions over how the Fed might intervene when something goes wrong. For example, when Silicon Valley Bank ran into financial trouble in 2023, the Fed stepped in to lend it money. Would those decisions now be subject to White House review?
Catherine says the problem with this approach is if the White House begins to meddle in some functions of the Fed, it would undermine other decisions made by the individuals at the Fed.
You have these individuals who are playing multiple roles, and how credible is it that they're going to maintain independence on one front and not others?
Fed Chair Jerome Powell has been fielding more questions lately over whether his decisions on interest rates will be influenced by Trump or, for that matter, Elon Musk. Here's what Powell told a House committee last month about potential executive branch interference.
What we're going to do at the Fed is keep our heads down and keep working, wait to see what new policies emerge, and try to make a thoughtful, sensible set of policies on our part once we understand the implications of those.
We reached out to the White House to ask how this division would be managed. According to a senior administration official, the Office of Management and Budget will oversee all the Fed's regulations not related to monetary policy. We also asked if it could erode the credibility of the Fed's decisions to raise or lower interest rates. The same statement said no, and to, quote, include that accusation in your story would not be accurately reporting the executive order. Darian Woods.
Waylon Wong, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. from NPR News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump says peace in Ukraine is now up to Russia after Ukraine agreed to a U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire. For weeks, the White House has been pressuring Ukraine, the country that Russia invaded. NPR's Franco Ordonez has this story on the effectiveness of a morally uncomfortable strategy.
Russian planes were in the air and tanks were rolling across your border. You told me
3 years ago, during a secret trip to Kyiv and standing next to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, President Biden said he wanted to leave no doubt about U.S. support for the war.
Remind us that freedom is priceless. It's worth fighting for as long as it takes. And that's how long we're going to be with you, Mr. President, for as long as it takes.
For as long as it takes. It's a very different message than the one President Trump delivered to Zelensky a few weeks ago.
I don't think you'd be a tough guy without the United States. And your people are very brave. But you're either going to make a deal or we're out. And if we're out, you'll fight it out. I don't think it's going to be pretty.
The dramatic reversal raised uncomfortable questions about whether the U.S. is switching sides, supporting Russia instead of the smaller country it invaded.
The first thing to understand is that the main reason for the difference with the Biden strategy is that they have different goals.
That's Jeremy Shapiro, former Obama administration official. He says the Biden administration wanted to make sure that aggression was not rewarded and that Russia would not be able to prey on Ukraine again. While the Trump administration is almost exclusively focused on ending the fighting. And by not playing favorites, Shapiro says, Trump can use coercion on both sides, even against an ally.
If you give your ally a sort of sense that you will support their goals no matter what, they're unlikely to be willing to make the kind of compromises that are necessary to end the war.
Shapiro says the Biden approach, while admirable, failed to reflect Russian momentum and the political winds against the war in the U.S.
While I think that the Trump administration's policy represents a much cooler world, a place that I'm less enthused to live in than I am in Biden's world, I think it's a more realistic appreciation of what the United States can actually accomplish.
Samuel Cherup, a political analyst with the RAND Corporation, has long argued that talking to Russia is in U.S. national interest.
Talking is not a gift. It's a way of getting things done.
And to Trump's credit, Cherup says Putin appears to be responding. Putin hasn't ended the war, but there have been gestures, such as releasing Mark Fogel, the American teacher who was deemed wrongfully detained by Russia.
Like, rubber is going to hit the road sometime soon, because Trump clearly has more than just reopening channels of communication for its own sake in mind, and he wants to actually end the war.
Putin has yet to accept the offer, but the White House is already claiming some validation for the strategy. Here's Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt.
This is the closest we have been to peace in this war. We are at the 10th yard line, and the president is expecting the Russians to help us run this into the end zone.
But even if Russia agrees, it has a long record of broken pledges and treaty violations, says Leanna Fix of the Council on Foreign Relations.
I think it would be very naive to trust Russia's words in negotiations, because from all the historical experience that we have.
And while Trump has warned Russia of potential financial sanctions, he's asked Putin for very few concessions. Shapiro, who is now at the European Council on Foreign Relations, calls it the flaw of Trump's strategy.
It's actually a huge mistake to be nice to Putin. You should be able to be mean to everybody at the same time.
What's interesting, Shapiro points out, is that Trump is usually pretty good at that. Just not so much when it involves Putin. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Life after retirement can be isolating for a lot of people, older men in particular. Turns out that making a difference to someone else's life can give older guys a boost. Here's Ashley Meltite.
When Jim Eisenberg of White Plains, New York, first became a grandfather, he wanted to meet other men at the same stage of life and do things together. So he went online.
Trying to find any kind of organization with grandpas. There were a lot of things with grandmas, which we always say, God love grandmas.
But nothing for grandfathers. Ultimately, Jim and his friend Frank Williams founded their own group. They called it Grandpas United. Jim and Frank wanted to bring retired men together socially and give them a continued sense of purpose. Here's Frank.
A lot of guys don't play golf. What do? You can give back. You can serve.
Frank works as head of the White Plains Youth Bureau, and he saw a particular need.
So many children are growing up without a male figure or a father. And then here we have men who are retiring from work and careers.
So he and Jim started popping up at local farmers markets and recruiting older men to join them as mentors. Grandpa's United works with boys and young men. Today, several grandpas gather at a White Plains elementary school. They hang out with fourth grade boys here every couple of weeks.
All right, are we ready to play chess here?
John Stewart, okay, a former IT guy, is playing with David, who's nine. We're not using David's full name because of his age. John explains the roles of bishop, knight, and queen.
She can do anything except for the knight's move.
So you can, like, protect her?
Yes.
Programs like this have real benefits, says Dr. Linda Freed. Today, she's dean of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. A few decades ago, she was a practicing geriatrician and noticed a recurring pattern.
They started having patient after patient for whom the reasons they were truly sick were that they had no reason to get up in the morning.
They felt they had no value in society. That galvanized her to start Experience Corps. A study on the outcomes showed striking results.
Men who were volunteers demonstrated over a 2-year period an astounding increase in the size of their brain.
In the regions associated with problem solving and memory. Why? Freed says it may be that because older men socialize less than women to begin with, the consistent volunteer work and seeing they were making a difference did them the most good. Sociology professor Dawn Carr of Florida State University says knowing their community has needs they could fill could appeal to a lot of older men.
Who otherwise might feel more comfortable in the safety of their house watching television throughout the day alone, which is actually the activity that older men engage in more than anything else.
Ann Carr says there's another upside to volunteering.
You're able to do something where you feel like you have meaning and purpose, but you're doing it alongside other people who have a similar shared purpose.
Grandpa's United member Mark Scharf knows this firsthand.
One of the things that I love about grandpas is not only with the kids, it's the camaraderie and building new friendships, and I cherish that.
He feels great satisfaction helping boys and young men while staying connected with older ones. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses, at Easy Cater.
Just leave me there all alone.